From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll find out why the Valley's agricultural research programs are feeling the pain of California's drought. We'll also talk some foreign policy that has a connection here in the Valley. The situation in Syria, the town of Kassab. This traditional Armenian community has found itself at the center of the Syrian conflict as of late. We'll talk with Fresno State's Barlow Dermurgadichian about the impact of that situation on the Armenian community worldwide and here in the Valley. We'll also talk about the San Joaquin Valley's architectural heritage and find out about some events coming up in the next few days that celebrate that history. But first, last week, the state of California released a new interactive online map that lets you look at how environmentally burdened your neighborhood is. The tool, called CalEnviroScreen 2.0, combines both data on pollution sources and the demographics of a community, including poverty, unemployment, and linguistic isolation, to compute a score that reflects a community's overall environmental burden. The list was not good news for the Valley, where air and water pollution, pesticides, and toxic waste combine with chronic poverty. Of the 10 worst census tracts in the state, 8 of them were from Fresno. Experts call these disparities environmental justice, or in this case, the lack thereof. In a moment, we'll talk with Sarah Sharp, the Director of Programs for Fresno Metro Ministry, about what these numbers mean for the Valley. But first, we're joined by Sam Delson with the California Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, which helped prepare these numbers to tell us more about the data itself. Sam, welcome.
Thank you very much.
This data set combines two different categories of data. You're looking at both pollution sources and also demographic information. Exactly how do you merge those two together, and why do you merge them together?
Well, there are a dozen pollution burden indicators, and those are divided into exposures such as ozone, diesel, particulate matter, pesticide use, toxic releases, and environmental effects such as cleanup sites, impaired water bodies, and hazardous waste facilities. And so those 12 pollution burden indicators are combined to produce a score from 1 to 10 for each of the 8,000 census tracts in the state. And then there are 12 population characteristics indicators such as asthma rates, low birth weight deliveries, unemployment rate, poverty, and those produce a second score from 1 to 10. And then we multiply the two scores to produce the CalEnviroScreen score.
And that really strikes at the principle of this idea of environmental justice. Can you define how the state defines that?
Well, there's an exact definition that I don't have right in front of me.
Well, I mean, just for the layman's perspective.
It's ensuring that the state carries out its environmental justice mission, its environmental mission, in a manner that ensures that all Californians are treated fairly, including minority and low-income groups. And so this tool is designed to identify communities that are facing challenges that have both burdens from pollution sources such as pesticides or ozone or drinking water issues, as well as vulnerabilities from their population characteristics such as high poverty rates, low education attainment, and health issues such as asthma and low birth weight deliveries, because there's documented research that shows that when you have those population vulnerabilities, the same level of pollution can affect you more strongly.
Now, how does the state hope to utilize this new data?
Well, the main purpose is to help CalEPA and its departments prioritize their limited resources. So to prioritize cleanup actions, enforcement actions, as well as grants and investments to assist disadvantaged communities. In particular, there's a state law passed in 2012 that requires that a quarter of all the revenue generated by the cap-and-trade auctions of greenhouse gas emission allowances be invested in projects that benefit the disadvantaged communities identified by this tool. Now, there are other secondary uses. We're hoping that local and other state agencies will also use this to prioritize some of their investments and grant making. Some banks have expressed interest in using that in prioritizing their investments. And it's something that the general public can use. We have these interactive maps, and you can just plug in any address or any city, click on any point on the map, and it will show you the data for each of the 19 indicators in each of the 8,000 census tracts in the state. So you can see what is the information for your community, see how it compares with your perception and your experience of the issues around you, and how it compares to other communities around the state.
And you can find the online map on our website. The link is there at kvpr.org. Sam, I understand there's an event coming up in Fresno. Tell me more about that.
That's correct. Because we want to get public input on ways to improve this tool and make it more effective, we're going to be holding three public workshops around the state, and one of them will be in Fresno on May 6th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Huburn State Building on Mariposa Mall.
Again, we've been talking with Sam Delson today on Valley Edition. He is with the California Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, which recently released the new CalEnviroScreen 2.0 database that tracks environmental burdens in neighborhoods throughout the state. Sam, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Joining us now in the studio, we have Sarah Sharp. She is the Director of Programs for Fresno Metro Ministry. Sarah, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thank you for having me.
The numbers that came out last week were dramatic. Even more dramatic, though, was the map that was released by CalEnviroScreen. And you pull up the Central Valley, zooming out from a large 40,000-foot perspective, you look at California, the most of the center of the state is red. You zoom in further, and the worst areas in the state, and in this case red is bad, the worst areas of the state are right in Fresno and specifically in West Fresno. These have to be sobering numbers for anyone who works in this field, looking at this data in that perspective.
Definitely. It's very sobering and concerning. It's a call to action for us, of course. We've been working on these issues at Fresno Metro Ministry for quite a while. We do applaud CalEPA and OEHA for coming out with this analysis because it tells the story that many of us already knew. Those of us who live in these neighborhoods and have been grown up here knew that we had severe environmental burden that we believed was greater than a lot of other places in the state, but we didn't have any data to prove it. So that's one of the things that we are hopeful will come out of this analysis, is that we will really get some more action and some policy changes that come from what we've seen.
We've talked about this issue of disparities, whether they're health disparities, economic disparities, all sorts of things in the valley. If you look at Fresno on this map, on the far northern edge and the far eastern edge, you see green areas. Green in this case is on the good scale, and red in this case is on the bad scale. Fresno itself is very much divided. It's not a uniform state across the community.
Right. This is another tale of two cities issue that we've been hearing about for years in Fresno. In this case, it looks like the north boundary is almost Shields in most cases, and everything south of Shields is red. But then we also have the 99 corridor and the 41 corridor, which are also very environmentally burdened. And so part of the disparities that we see throughout Fresno and the tale of two cities is that part of our population doesn't score as high on the community vulnerability index. And so that may explain why some of our neighbors in Fresno have a healthier environment.
I want to jump in here and ask you about that specifically. This issue of environmentally burdened is an interesting concept because we're not just looking at pure pollution data, although it's probably the easiest way to talk about this map as being a pollution map. But you're also looking at the socioeconomic thing. And we talked to Sam Delson about this. But you're combining these two things together. Can you explain why something like linguistic isolation or unemployment has an impact on the vulnerability of someone or of a community to pollution?
Yes. So this is the story of environmental justice and the movement that's been around since the 80s, talking about why certain populations, certain neighborhoods cannot respond as well to pollution as others. First of all, we have a problem with historic decisions about zoning and code and planning for our cities. We used to always put the industrial areas next to where the people of color and the working class people had to live by law. And so that's a historical background that we're working within. And then over time, those communities that are living in poverty, have lower education levels, or are new to our country often do not have the same resources and tools to access the protections that we have through Environmental Protection Agency or through our local zoning or other systems that people in other neighborhoods might be able to access easier.
If you look at California's history of environmental laws, even regionally with air quality districts like we have here in the Valley, we apply broad implementation of various directives, rules, laws, either across the whole state or over a whole region. In this case, we're talking about down to the neighborhood level. Should we be looking at these things in a different way, a much more neighborhood-focused way, looking at the granularity of this data and at this map?
Actually, that's exactly what CalEnviroScreen 2.0 is about. They took the same information that they had last year at the zip code level, and through their community workshops and listening to communities like West Fresno here in Fresno that wanted more detail and wanted it zeroed in to a smaller scale, they responded to the community and came out with this census tract level analysis, which we believe is much more accurate about telling the detailed story of environmental justice and how there are disparities in every city and throughout our state. And so for us, the 8,000 census tracts are much better than the, I think it was like almost 2,000 zip codes, because the zip code areas were so large, they would encompass some areas that were not necessarily, you know, high vulnerability neighborhoods, but the zip codes were just so large.
So we have this great map. We have this great data. It tells us more about what we kind of already had a hunch was going on. How can this be used?
So for us, we believe that having good data is very important for decision making. And that's what we work a lot on at Fresno Metro Ministry, is getting the academic research in place to really help our decision makers, our policy makers, have the right information they need to make the right decisions. So that goes from state level all the way down to local level, from the general plan general plan update that we're working on here in Fresno. We can look at which neighborhoods and census tracts in Fresno need more attention, need more investment. It's not a new, you know, it pretty much mirrors where the bus rapid transit and other investments were going to be focused by the city. So from that local, very local level to the statewide level, this analysis was actually created in response to AB 32, and they needed CalEPA to define disadvantaged communities. And so that was the impetus for this analysis. And so the top 10% communities, which, as you can see on the map, most of Fresno fit in, you know, a lot of Fresno County, actually, and a lot of the San Joaquin Valley, will really benefit from being red in that respect, because there are going to be a lot of investments of that cap and trade money in our communities.
West Fresno is of particular concern. It ranks at the bottom of the bottom, essentially, in the CalEnviroScreen list. That community has a host of environmental burdens, a lot of heavy industry, air quality issues and related to the transportation infrastructure in that area. There's also an ongoing issue with the Darling Meat rendering plant there and this lawsuit that continues to go on. How does that factor into this?
Well, I think this tool and this analysis will really help our city council understand how important that issue is and how serious it is. It's not a joke. And we were not kidding about being really concerned about it, because when you look at on the statewide level, West Fresno pops up as one of the top most heavily environmentally burdened communities. That's very concerning, and we need to make sure we take some action. I think we've been in kind of a state of paralysis from analysis over the last few years, and it's time to take some action and really change our policies about where we put our industrial uses. There are still new processing facilities and chemical plants trying to go into West Fresno as we speak, and our current policies allow for that. So our city council, I think we all need to, as a community, look at what we can do differently, how we can make sure that our whole city is treated as one healthy Fresno. We want to be one healthy Fresno. I think we need to find a way to get to that point.
Your group has been involved with the general plan and trying to direct a new future for the city. You mentioned about not having those new facilities, those new heavy industry projects going in those traditional areas. Well, where would they go in the future then? If they aren't going in?
I think that's a very important conversation that we need to have as a community, and it's actually happening across the nation. Like I said, historically, it was accepted that you would just pick one part of town and put all of your industry, heavy industry, in that spot. But unfortunately, there are usually residential areas near there. And so the people who have to live there are usually the people who have no choice about where they live because they can't either afford to move somewhere else or for other reasons. So as a country, we're looking at that because we need to figure out, but probably we need to allow for industrial in other areas that have none. And of course, you know, some people wouldn't be happy about that. But if we want to be fair and all about democracy, we kind of have to figure out how to either reduce our waste and have less polluting facilities that we wouldn't mind living next to, or we need to figure out how to what else we can do.
So what's the next step at this point?
Well, we're going to take it and share it with our city council. It clearly points to the need to approve our general plan update and move forward with some smart planning and changing the way we do business as usual. We're going to do a community forum on May 13th with some of the city council members who represent the south part of Fresno, and really talk to them about what this means, not just this, but you know, all of the stories that our residents that live in South Fresno have about how different it is to live in South Fresno versus North Fresno. So on May 13th at Roosevelt, we're going to be there talking with our city councilmen and hoping that we can see some action soon.
Again, we've been talking with Sarah Sharp. She is the director of programs for Fresno Metro Ministry, a local nonprofit organization that's doing work in the area of environmental justice. We've been talking about CalEnviroScreen 2.0, a new data tool that has been released by the state of California, came out last week and features an online interactive map that tracks the environmental burden of all of California's census tracts. So you can find out how burdened your neighborhood is. Is it in red? Is it in green? Or is it somewhere in between? You can find that online as well on our website, kvpr.org. Sarah Sharp, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Last Thursday, Armenians around the world marked the somber occasion of the 99th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide. Around 1.5 million Armenians are estimated to have died in what is now known as the first genocide of the 21st century. This year, the fighting in Syria, and specifically in one traditional Armenian community, Kassab, has brought the memories of a century ago alive in a new and frightening way for the Valley's Armenian community. Here to tell us more about the situation in Kassab, some context on that situation, and also about the remembrance of the Armenian Genocide is Barlow Derbergadichian. He is the coordinator of Fresno State's Armenian Studies Program. Barlow, welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
The struggle for recognition has been a big challenge, a big goal for the Armenian community in the United States and across the world for many years. Earlier this month, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee adopted a resolution commemorating the genocide and its observance. The president issued a statement last Thursday as well, but the president stopped short of using the word genocide. What are your thoughts on the continued hesitancy by many in America's government from using that word?
Well, I think we've gotten, in a sense, used to presidents promising as candidates to use the word genocide and to support the Armenian cause in terms of the genocide. And then we see once that presidents have been elected, including President Obama, that they decide not to use the word genocide in their annual statement, but rather use a euphemism. In this case, he uses the term Medzeren, which is an Armenian term, which means the great crime. Well, there's not really much difference between a great crime and genocide, so I take that as a good point in terms of what he's saying. But we have to also remember that, you know, previous presidents of the United States have used the word genocide, including President Reagan. So this is just a political posturing, trying not to upset Turkey.
Speaking of Turkey, Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan issued a statement last week saying, having experienced events which had inhumane consequences, such as relocation during the First World War, should not prevent Turks and Armenians from establishing compassion and mutually humane attitudes towards one another. How was that statement received in the Armenian community?
In the case of Turkey, we have to always look at it in the context of the longer Turkish relations with the Armenians. So ever since the Armenian genocide, the Turkish government official position has been denial of genocide. But in the past five or 10 years now with the new prime minister and his party, that has begun to change that relationship. And this is a very good first step in the sense that for the first time a prime minister is officially talking about those events. He's not calling it genocide, but he's talking about it. But it is basically sort of a repackaged denial of the Armenian genocide, because really it's not the issue between the two peoples. It's between the government of Turkey and the Armenian people, because the government of Turkey continues to deny the genocide.
What changes once that word is used?
Well, I think it opens up a whole series of opportunities for normalization of relations. For instance, today the Republic of Armenia and Turkey do not have diplomatic relations, because Turkey says that the Armenian Republic has to say that there was no genocide or drop the genocide issue in order to do that. That's not normal. I think we want Armenia to have normal relations with its neighbors. And for the Armenians living in the diaspora, we want that peace of mind that says that the genocide which occurred will not be denied. Denial means that the Turkish government tries to say that nothing ever happened. And so the Armenians want that peace of mind that would come with recognition. And then there's a whole host of other issues, of course, that could be discussed.
How has the general understanding outside of the diaspora, outside of the Armenian community itself, changed, improved over the past few decades about what happened in 1915 and the years thereafter?
That's a great question, because, again, it's a way of looking at it. You can't just look at a snapshot today and say, you know, we're somewhere or where we are. We have to look at the past two decades. And in the past two decades, I think there's been great momentum in foreign governments, among foreign leaders, parliaments, intellectuals, all basically coming out and publicly saying that it was a genocide, that what took place was a genocide. And therefore, they're looking to seek from Turkey some sort of acknowledgement of that genocide. In particular, Turkey was trying to get into the European Union recently. And one of the big issues was acknowledgement of the Armenian genocide, that to be a member of Europe, that the government of Turkey has to acknowledge the genocide.
One of the concerns with the Armenian genocide, with any group that experienced such tragedy, such a terrible situation in the 20th century, and there have been several, is to prevent it from happening again, to prevent such an ethnic cleansing from occurring again in the future, and to remind ourselves of the horrors of those things. And unfortunately, the situation in Syria has brought those memories to the fore. The Armenian community of Kassab, which is in northwest Syria along the Turkish border, is long been a home for Armenian Christians. And in the current strife in Turkey between the Assad regime and the rebel fighters, some of them affiliated with Al-Qaeda, they swept into this province last month, seized a number of towns in this strategically important mountain region, and forced those longtime residents out of their city. This has caused international outrage, international concern. Tell us a little more about this part of the world and the Armenian community there.
Well, in Syria, there's the two big cities are Aleppo and Damascus, and there's a very large Armenian community that existed in Aleppo, because Aleppo is just across the border from Turkey. And in the 1915 Armenian genocide, when Armenians were being deported to their deaths, most of the deportation routes led to first Aleppo and then from Aleppo out into the Syrian desert to Deir Zor. The consequence was that for some Armenians who did survive, they actually just stayed in Aleppo. So since the Armenian genocide of 1915, a very large and important Armenian community had developed in Aleppo, over 150,000 Armenians, with schools, churches, and the entire sort of structure of an Armenian culture there. Also, it was important because it was still close to the historic homelands. In addition to that, there were historic areas such as Kesab, which you mentioned. Kesab is a smaller village, but also historically important because it was once part of the Armenian kingdom of Cilicia. So what I'm saying is that the civil war in Syria then really tore apart the Armenian community in Aleppo. And then suddenly this occurrence in Kesab just last month really brought open the wounds of the genocide, because Turkey had to have allowed those militants to come into that area so that the Armenians would be driven out. And many Armenians believe that it was Turkish government complicity that allowed those militants to come in.
What was the response like in the Armenian community across the globe to the situation in Kassab?
Well, unfortunately, it was an anguished reaction, as you can imagine. Any Armenians that had relatives there, and many have still relatives there, or are Armenians that had come from Kesab or from other places, again, it's just emblematic of this whole situation of the genocide that Armenians are vulnerable. And as Christian Armenians, they are vulnerable. And so it's a great sense of sadness, outrage that this could happen again, and seeking that the American government in particular use its influence to try to resolve that situation.
NPR reported on this situation last week. They spoke with the editor of an Armenian daily newspaper in Lebanon, Shahan Kandaharian, and he told NPR, "The future is not clear for the whole Christian community in the Middle East, not just the Armenians. We've seen what happens to Christians in Iraq," referencing the thousands of Christians who fled as extremism has risen there in the past decade. Do you have concerns along those lines beyond Syria and for the Armenian community in many of these countries in the Middle East?
I think the quote pretty much framed the whole situation, which is it's not only an Armenian Christian situation, that for the past several decades, as tensions have risen in various areas of the Middle East, Christians have been particularly targeted for persecution and forcing Christians to leave because the situation has become unlivable. Armenians are a subsection of the larger Christian population and are particularly, again, vulnerable for the reasons that were talked about. And so it, again, is something that we are concerned about because Armenians in Iraq have been disrupted. The community has been disrupted. Now in Syria, Lebanon is foreseeably on the next step. And in other places, Egypt has already seen an Armenian community, a longstanding community, been disrupted many years ago. So these are all things that we need to be worried about and we need to be proactive about to make sure that we don't see a whole new group of refugees from these areas.
One of the individuals NPR spoke with who asked not to be identified, an Armenian who lives in Beirut, was born in Beirut and has lived there his whole life, he says and told the network, "I always have all my documents ready," he says, "in case the political or security situation changes and he's forced to flee." Is that an all too typical response?
Well, I don't know enough to say that it's everyone's response, but I think now in the back of a mind of an Armenian Christian living in these areas, that certainly they have to be looking out for the safety of their families. And whatever that takes, whether it's moving to a safer area. Actually, many Armenians in the Syrian civil war had moved to Kesab and surrounding regions, believing that it was more secure because it was an area which was inhabited by the sect that is closest to the Assad family, the Alawis. And so It's unbelievable now that those safe areas have also become areas that people have to flee from. So it, again, puts in danger the whole community.
Moving outside of the situation in Syria and the Middle East to Armenia itself and its larger position on the global stage right now, as Russia seems increasingly headed to some sort of confrontation or standoff with the West over the situation in Ukraine. How does that affect Armenian foreign policy and the nation of Armenia?
Well, it's a complicated issue. Armenia was part of the Soviet Union for 71 years. It's still in a region which it depends heavily on Russian aid and Russian military protection from Turkey. So the Armenian government is in a very delicate position. They cannot be seen as being too close to the West, to Europe, when Russia is seeking its own strategic gains, let's put it that way. I think it's just a complicated issue. They're trying to manage that issue as best they can. But, of course, there's a whole series of threats and problems associated with that.
I want to close with one other quote from this article that ran on NPR last week. And this is from a member of an Armenian Catholic church in Beirut speaking about the situation, talking about in the context of the genocide and the situation in Syria, and talking about how, despite all of these concerns, he is hopeful for the future. And he said, quote, "Perhaps it's our Armenian. We've learned from our history that after every bad thing comes a better thing. Otherwise, we couldn't have survived all those centuries." Is that something that you agree with, can relate to?
Oh, yes, very definitely. Armenians have had this sort of inner strength to always say that no matter what happens, we're going to start the whole process again. That is, no matter how bad an invasion may be, a war or something, that Armenians also will go out and build. They'll go out and work hard to recreate and to rebuild. And so that's a very positive attitude, and an attitude which we see here for the Armenian community that has lived in the United States as a result of the genocide, and they have built themselves into a prosperous community.
We've been talking with Barlo Dermirgadichian, the coordinator of Fresno State's Armenian Studies Program, joining us today on Valley Edition. Barlo, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and talk to one of the Valley's leading ag journalists, Todd Fichette of Western Farm Press. He has an interesting story about how California's drought is affecting scientists here in the Valley. That's coming up next on Valley Edition.
Valley Public Radio's annual wine tasting is coming up Sunday, May 4th. Join us at the Lester Estate in Fresno for the 30th anniversary of FM 89's signature fundraising event. Mastering the Art of Wine will feature wine from over 40 vintners and delicious hors d'oeuvres from Chef Roy Harlan of the Elbow Room, plus live music and a silent auction. Tickets and details for Sunday, May 4th are available online at kvpr.org.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. May is almost here, and that means we're entering the peak of the growing season, those sunny days and warm temperatures that make the San Joaquin Valley the most productive ag region in the world. But in this drought year, everything is a little bit different. Here to tell us more is Todd Fichette. He is the associate editor of Western Farm Press, a trade publication that covers agriculture throughout the western U.S. Todd is based in Tulare and covers ag here in the Central Valley. You can read his work online at westernfarmpress.com. Todd, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You had a very interesting article in the publication about a week or so ago about the impact the drought is having on not just farmers but ag research programs, specifically the UC ag research programs here in the Central Valley. What sort of impact are we talking about there?
Oh, that's widespread. The University of California is a land-grant institution here in California. And so they do the work with the growers. You have farm advisors in a bunch of different crops. And their ability to do research is based on, one, if they have cooperators, they have actual commercial farmers working with them. And two, in several areas of the state, you have research farms like the Westside Research Center, Kearney Research Center in Fresno County. And they need water for the crops that they're working with and the studies they're doing. And if they don't have that water, they certainly can't do those studies. I know the Westside Research Station told all its researchers to cut back on the amount of water that they were using. They didn't micromanage them and say, okay, you can't do this specific study. It's, hey, you just need to cut by X percent, and you figure that out. You figure out what that's going to mean to your research. And so some researchers just decided not to even start a project. Others were cutting back to what they thought they could for research purposes. I mean, you get a plot of land, as it gets smaller and smaller, your data set isn't as reliable as I understand. You need a certain size of plot to make your data as reliable as possible for peer review.
I was talking with a friend the other day, and they remarked that if you just drive up and down Highway 99 through the valley, you see almond orchards that are green, you see green vineyards as far as the eye can see. You wouldn't necessarily know if you didn't already have this context and reading the stories about the drought that we're in the middle of this terrible dry spell. Certainly that is not the case everywhere. You go other parts of the valley and the effects of the drought are more visible to the naked eye. But does that thus say how resilient California agriculture is? But what are you seeing along those lines?
Well, farmers are resilient, and that's really what amazes me. I didn't grow up on a farm. My dad was an auto mechanic, and so that's how we ate. And for me, it's fascinating to learn about this. But there is kind of an interesting story, so to speak. You can see with your eyes new almond orchards being planted, new pistachios being planted, a lot of permanent crops being planted. And there's kind of a, well, why are we planting permanent crops if there's no water for them? Well, that has to do a lot with the price. any of the nut crops, particularly pistachios, almonds, walnuts, the prices are – the returns to the grower is really good. And grapes, the return is pretty good to the growers from what I understand. So, you look around, you see green, you think, life's grand. But, farmers do what they have to do. They use drip irrigation for these plants. They're not flooding them. And so they're just putting on minute amounts of water, just what the crop needs. And it's, for the untrained eye, it might be kind of a different viewpoint, so to speak.
And it also, I guess, speaks to this, the fact that the valley is not this one uniform area. Different parts of the valley are feeling the effects of this drought in different ways. Different growers and different industries are feeling it in different ways. The citrus growers kind of faced a 1-2 punch this year with last December's freeze, now the drought. Many in Tulare County are facing big problems in that they don't have a backup water supply this year. And communities of Terrabella and those areas, they're certainly feeling the pain. What are you seeing along those lines? Are growers trying to save their orchards in any way, or are they just giving up?
Oh, they're not giving up. I talked to a grower the other day, and that's the last thing on his mind is to give up. He's relatively young. He's got a young family, got a couple children in grade school, and almost kind of the Norman Rockwell type of situation. You go out there and you look. He's not giving up at all. He predominantly gets surface water through the east side, and it's a long story on how east side, west side water
Frying
works.
Yeah, Frying Canal, all that stuff, yeah.
And what have you. But he does have a little bit, and when I say a little bit, I mean a little bit of well water. They don't have a large aquifer in that area of Orange Cove and what have you that the growers can draw upon. So if you're fortunate enough to be able to punch a hole in the ground and get a little bit of water, then you've got a little bit of water for your trees. And that idea is really just keeping them alive, because a tree is a long-term investment. It's not like a row crop where, okay, I can choose to plant lettuce this year, or I can choose to plant broccoli or not. And if I don't plant those, then maybe I can free up a little bit of water for a permanent crop, which are what some farmers are already doing. They're deciding not to plant row crops and free up what water they have or can get or can buy it at $1,000, $2,000 an acre foot for their trees. And trees are profitable. And so that's why you see a lot of trees right now. But oranges, for instance, they took it hard. They had that freeze in the first part of December. Cost, I can't recall the number, but it was a large number that they basically lost in terms of what it cost them to try to protect that crop and the loss of the crop itself. And now they're looking at zero allocation for water. And it's not going to be pretty, particularly for the citrus growers.
In the past few years, growers in California have faced labor shortages. Are we going to see that change this year with the drought and with so many acres out of production, especially on the west side, those workers freed up to maybe go where the jobs are?
Well, labor is certainly going to be an issue. I mean, if you talk to Farm Bureau, labor is pretty much the issue. They've got a number of issues on the table, but labor is one of them. The issue, as I see it, is not just the amount of people who are available today to pick or to plant or to do the pruning or what have you. There aren't the jobs out there today. So I'm reading stories that tell me that farm laborers are sitting around their phones waiting for somebody to call them, waiting for a job. And they can wait only so long because they have families too. And so they're going to make a decision. Do I pick up and take the whole family with me to the Salinas Valley, for instance? Can I take the family with me to the Coachella Valley to do work, or do I go? Or how many of us go? Do we leave the kids behind with grandma and grandpa, for instance, and go tend to the farms in other areas, or what? All I know is farm workers are hurting just as bad as the growers.
You cover agriculture up and down the state. In fact, you were writing just the other day online about how California's ag industry isn't just right here in the center of the state.
No.
It's everywhere.
Yeah.
Are there any parts of the state that are faring better or worse than others in this drought, and how do they relate to the valley?
Northern California might shoot me for this one, but Northern California, the Sacramento Valley, does seem to be doing a little bit better. They're arguably closer to the sources of water. You've got Shasta Lake. You've got Orville Lake. Orville Lake is on the Feather River watershed. And just recently, the senior rights, water rights growers on the Feather River watershed were told they were going to get 100% of their allocation. And, you know, if you're a Westside grower and you're hearing stories like that, wow, that's it'd be interesting to know what's going through their mind at that time. But that's good for the rice growers. And it's predominantly rice up there in the Sacramento Valley. About 90% of the acreage in those irrigation districts, I'm told, are rice. So you'll see some rice wetlands go into production this year. In fact, they're working that land right now. And that's fascinating, too, because the rice is not just a crop that gets sold globally. Those rice fields are also basically private wetlands and private refuges for a lot of birds. There's millions of birds that use those lands every year and get a benefit out of them.
And those growers who don't have surface water this year are increasingly turning to their backup reserve, their groundwater supplies.
If they have it.
If they have it, exactly.
And some of them don't. They're drilling wells. There's huge costs for drilling some of these wells. I've heard anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million a well. And so that's a lot of money.
Certainly so. I've also talked to some growers now who generally are pretty averse to any talk about regulations or increased regulations, but the issue of groundwater, knowing that there's going to be water in that well when they go to draw on it. One grower I was talking with who's a large pistachio and diversified grower here in the valley was saying we need to do something at some level, whether it's locally or statewide, to look at establishing some rules as far as taking water out of the ground. Is that something that we're starting to hear more of in the ag industry right now, or at least concern about, you know, your neighbor puts in a well and all of a sudden is drawing your water down?
There is that concern. And there was an issue, for instance, up in Northern California earlier in the season when it looked like they were going to be pumping a lot. And so you and I have wells and you turn your well on and you create this what's called a cone of depression. Well, if my well isn't deep enough to cover that, then my well might start sucking air. And so you and I might not have a good relationship after that. You've got those issues. The groundwater, something is going to have to be done because we can't really see it. I mean, we can look at a lake and we can see the lake's half full, or we can measure the water in the reservoir, but we really can't see what's underground. And so, yeah, there's a lot of talk about that. And the popular press is talking about that too. So, you know, politicians react to what they read in the newspapers as well.
Again, our guest today on Valley Edition has been Todd Fichette. He is the associate editor of Western Farm Press, a trade publication that covers agriculture throughout the western United States. Todd is based in Tulare and covers ag here in the Central Valley. You can read his work online at westernfarmpress.com and follow him on Twitter as well. Todd, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're listening to Valley Edition. The San Joaquin Valley has a rich architectural heritage. From gems like the Fresno Water Tower to Bakersfield's Beale Memorial Clock Tower to beautiful craftsman bungalows and mid-century modern masterpieces, those landmarks help give our communities their own unique identities. And beginning this Saturday, the city of Fresno will kick off a week-long celebration of that very thing with a number of events taking place as part of Historic Preservation Week. Joining us now to tell us more about what's happening and how you can take part is Karana Hattersley-Drayton. She is the Historic Preservation Manager for the city of Fresno, and Tim Patendis of Alina Foods, who owns a historic building that is part of the coming festivities. Karana and Tim, welcome to Valley Edition today.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you.
Karana, I want to start out with you. This is part of not just a Fresno activity, but a nationwide celebration of the nation's heritage that comes from a national organization.
That's
correct?
Right. It's from the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and they have been doing a May Preservation Month for years and years and years. And last year, several of us got together and we thought, maybe we can sort of celebrate this locally, get together. So several preservation partners got together, had a great successful week, and we decided to do it again. And I have to acknowledge and thank on the air the Fresno Historical Society, Heritage Fresno, Fresno Housing Authority, and the group out of Fresno State, Warner Center for the Performing Arts. And this year, which is really cool, Mr. Patendis and a couple of other property owners down in the South Van Ness area are working with us, and we're going to have our first actual activity this Saturday, which is a walking tour of the South Van Ness industrial area.
This is very interesting because I think a lot of people know the South Van Ness area only through maybe the Fresno sign, the historic Welcome to Fresno arch.
Right.
But there's a lot of really cool historic buildings in that area. One of them is owned by Tim Patendis, who joins us now. Tim, you have been in this building for over 10 years, and this is not just a museum. This is your business, but you have done a great job of restoring and keeping up this historic warehouse. Tell us about your building.
Well, our building was built in 1913, and it was opened by San Joaquin Grocers, wholesales. So it's got some age to it, but it's a beautiful building. And what we did was we came in, renovated it, and brought it up to standards to manufacture and process meats, which is regulated by the USDA. So we're a local manufacturer and distributor. So we process and distribute to local casinos and some accounts in the Nevada, Las Vegas area. So we took a lot of time to not only renovate, but to upgrade the building and still try to maintain, because it is such a beautiful building.
Can I add that it's rare because, as I think you know, Joe, it's a Mission Revival-style building, that great, you know, espadaña across the facade. And that's pretty rare for Fresno. You see it in the, you know, Santa Fe Station, but not too many commercial buildings, much less residential.
Now, you've been working with a lot of your neighbors in the area, neighboring property owners who also own historic buildings. And there seems like there's a little movement going on in fixing up some of these historic gems right in that area south of Freeway 41 along Van Ness Avenue. M Street, that general area. Tell us about that.
Correct. Two of my neighbors have actually grown up in that area, and their families had businesses there in the 40s and 50s. So we're real proud of that. And what we're trying to do is actually upgrade it, make it more welcoming and inviting for people to appreciate the history of Fresno and to show them, you know, how well we can maintain that and kind of revive that area. And Karina has some great ideas, too, to help get that started. But they're very passionate about what they're doing and real proud of the neighborhood.
And Karina, tell us a little more about that area
overall.
Sure. We have the old Fresno Brewing Company warehouse you see at the end of M Street that
right.
looks like something out of the Old West.
Yes, yeah, that's a great building.
And other buildings in that area as well.
Well, right. This walking tour on Saturday is our first official event after the mayoral proclamation at the City Council on Thursday. And so we're just going to be walking a fairly small area, but visiting about five or six buildings in this immediate. This is the Cherry, Los Angeles, Fulton area. So it's where five corners come together. This was the southern end of Armenian Town. You know, we have a very, very rich Armenian history here. And it was our fruit packing. And then, of course, during Prohibition, apparently some...
My building.
Yeah.
a little bit of a parties going on.
Yes.
Yeah, in our basement downstairs.
Interesting.
And it was the end of
Only
one of the...
those walls could talk.
Yeah. One of the end of one of the streetcar lines. And so there are two trolley cars that are not the greatest shape, but that are part of our historic fabric.
And
down
these
there.
Are... Original Fresno
yes,
trolley
correct.
Cars
yes,
that stopped in, what, 1939 or
yeah,
something. They're
yeah.
still
They're on. The last two that we are aware of from the Fresno Traction Company. They are on our local register. So those trolleys and Mr. Penendez Building, which is a San Joaquin Grocers, and Menend Candy Ice Cream Store, and Shams
gas station,
the Rio Grande. Anyway, there's going to be a nice little tour on Saturday, and it would be great to have folks come down and join us and learn more about this area.
Great, and that's from 10 till noon on Saturday, and that's a free event. Then next Friday, the Great Architects of Fresno, Historic Fresno Scavenger Hunt. This is a smartphone scavenger hunt. Tell me about this. I don't exactly know what that means. It's at the Warner's Theater, though.
So. Yeah. And I'm not very smart. I have a dumb phone. But this is something that is put on by Fresno State students and with Don Simmons, our chair of our Historic Preservation Commission. And it's great fun. And yeah, it's a scavenger hunt. But you have to use your smartphone and have your apps. And it's mostly the sort of younger guys running all over Fresno and lots of great prizes. So a fun way to learn about and connect to your city through sort of modern technology.
And then the next day, another walking tour that you're leading, and that is...
Yeah, I'm working this year. Last year, I just got to write the press releases. This year, it's like, okay, step up.
And this one is very exciting because it talks about Fresno's New Deal era architecture, and many Valley communities have great landmarks that are left from the 1930s and the era of FDR and the alphabet soup programs.
Right.
I think of the Visalia post office and Bakersfield
Fire Station
and some other great landmarks throughout our community. Fresno, of course, the Memorial Auditorium, the Hall of Records. Was that a conscious effort by the government to prescribe that these buildings were built in Art Deco style, or were there other styles involved?
Oh, no, definitely there's other styles. In fact, Art Deco, I'm going to guess, and I could be wrong, the phones will start to ring and I'll be corrected, but no, Art Deco was really unusual in it being explicitly and sort of purely used as it is in the Hall of Records. Mostly there was sort of this New Deal... Oh, gosh, what is it called? I'm going to blank out. But anyway, a New Deal style that was sort of a stripped-down, simpler version of Art Deco mixed with classicism. But then we have, as I think we were talking about earlier, we have our old Fresno City Hall Annex, which is now the Annex, considered one of the great modern buildings in the United States by the Museum of Modern Art in the 40s. I mean, so there was a whole variety, a whole palette, if you will, of styles.
Yeah, that's the City Hall before the current
spaceship. Yeah, the Klingon spaceship that landed. Yeah. Fresno, architecturally speaking, has always been kind of cutting edge, and I'm very proud of that. You know, we're not just a backwater community.
Yeah, so that's interesting. And the Hall of Records, of course, recently added to the National Register of Historic Places.
Gorgeous
that
building.
Is just such a gem that people, I don't know if they realize when they drive past on the street.
Well, we're going to try to point that out on Saturday, and the Historical Society and Heritage Fresno will be there on Saturday. Of course, I'm talking about Saturday the 10th at the Memorial Auditorium in the foyer, which is gorgeous, and there'll be exhibits and book sales and free refreshments, and everything is free other than the Mukes Home Tea.
Which we'll talk about in a second.
Yeah, and then the Friday night scavenger hunt, because that is a fundraiser.
So the Helm Home, this is often known as the Alamo House.
Yes.
In downtown Fresno on, I guess, L Street, just south of Divisadero. This has been sort of derelict for years and years and years, but now it's brought back to life.
Oh, absolutely. And this is, you know, in preservation, as Joe knows, we often don't win. We often lose. But this is an absolute win where, thanks to the Fresno Housing Authority, they did purchase it. I think Mayor Swearingen was very much behind that. I appreciate that. And the exterior has been completely restored, and now the interior. And there are tenants in there. And so this year, last year it was open just to look at the outside and talk about what was going on. This year the interior has been completely restored. And china from the Helm Home has been donated, and they've built a cabinet to show it off. So we're very excited.
Very exciting indeed. And then from that to another, that Helm Home tour is taking place on Saturday the 10th as well, noon to 2. And then also on Saturday the 10th, the Mukes Home has its
Annual Mother's Day tea, yes. And that is a ticketed event, so you can call the Mukes Home. Now, we do have our press release online, and people can call me, and we have a flyer. So I would like to see people come out and experience Fresno.
Great. And there's also a nice downloadable New Deal walking tour online.
I know
you just Google it, and Fresno New Deal,
right.
And it pops up. You can download that and find out about all those great historic buildings in Fresno. Again, we want to thank our guests today, Karana Hattersley Drayton, she's the Historic Preservation Manager for the City of Fresno, and Tim Patendis, owner of Alina Foods, who owns a historic building in the South Van Ness area, one of the buildings that's a part of this Saturday's walking tour of the South Van Ness historic area.
Can we mention where to meet? 175 Fulton Street, which is the Menand ice cream, and that's right across from Mr. Patendis' building, so
Great. That's
where we'll hope to see some people.
Yeah, that's 10 to noon on Saturday. Again, Karana and Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. You're welcome.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us talk@kvpr.org and follow us on Twitter. We're @KVPR. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.